All right, welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording on Thursday, August 12th, 2021, and I'm here with Sharifa Williams, who is not Rebecca Shinsky, subbing in while Rebecca is out. Sharifa, boy, you're our executive editor for Book Riot, and then you do science fiction and fantasy podcast with Jen Northington, SFF Yeah, which is a science fiction fantasy show. And it's interesting that you're here today because we're going to do a little adaptation follow-up talk, which is very SF focused on these days with stuff coming out. I always read the title of your show and I don't say it that much. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here and to talk about some of my favorite things, which are movies and TV and books. So
So let's do a sponsor break, and I've got some listener feedback about adapted series, but I do want to hear your takes about, if you've got them hot and ready in your holster, about Dune and Foundation, some other stuff coming out here pretty quick. But first, a quick sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
So last week, Sharifa, Rebecca and I were, I kind of pounced on Rebecca unawares about how with Dune and Foundation coming out this fall, there isn't to me another obvious sort of giant sequoia science fiction fantasy property out there left to be adapted. We talked about some that we'd like to see adapted, some that might be coming, like the N.K. Jemisins and some other things like that. But in terms of like canonical, most people even in pop culture have heard of them, we're sort of out. And based on listener feedback, I think that estimation is correct. There's one property that I'd be more excited than others, but it doesn't rise to those levels of most of us knowing about them. How are you feeling about where we are in the science fiction and fantasy adaptation world? Are you excited for Dune? Are you excited Foundation? Are you interested in Amazon's, I think, $1 billion whatever Atlantis Middle Earth second age series coming out in the fall? Where are you as a science fiction fantasy pop culture person on where we are in the sort of this late high age of science fiction fantasy cycle?
I feel like there are so many science fiction and fantasy adaptations coming out that I like my head is spinning a little and I can never I feel like I could never keep up with it. In terms of like Dune and Foundation, I tried to read Foundation and like when I was a very early it was I think when I was embarking upon reading more science fiction because I started out as a very fantasy heavy reader since I was a kid. But when I started to get into science fiction, I tried to read Foundation, and I did not enjoy the experience, to be honest. I DNF'd it. And so it's going to be interesting to me to see how they adapt it and whether that's going to pique my interest more than perhaps the book did or the series did. In terms of Dune, that's another behemoth I have not read, but I watched the earlier adaptation. And I thought it was cheesy, but I really enjoyed it as a young person because yeah. I like cheesy and, you know, I like B movies. So that's a whole thing. But the Dune adaptation, I think, is really interesting. I think it's like it is one of those big canonical works that a lot of people have read and took it upon themselves as a challenge to read. So I really want to watch it. I am not a purist about reading books before I watch anything. So I am definitely going to watch it and then decide whether I want to read the book for the first time for real. But I think that there have been, I think that Jemisin, like the Broken Earth series, that trilogy is definitely one I'm really excited to see adapted and that I would think of as like the most contemporary, like it's a contemporary classic. It's going to right. be on lists for a long time to come. And I also would be really interested in seeing maybe the Earthsea cycle reimagined for.
Yeah, I think that's one that we maybe mentioned that there's some Le Guin out there that
yeah.
is interesting. Yeah, I agree with that one as well. Your running mate over there, Jen, Jen jumped on the show what now seems like 17 years ago, pre-pandemic, when we got the first Dune trailer.
Yes.
And she's a super Dune nerd.
Yes.
And we were nerding out about it. It's been around a while, which I wonder if that lessens the interest in it, raises the interest in it. Give me a couple picks, though, on like idiosyncratic sci-fi fantasy stuff that maybe no one has heard of, or at least in the pop culture sense, that you would make good at. Like if you were out there acquiring for a Apple Plus Prime 2 or whatever. What would you go buy if you were in charge of adapting some cool SFFES stuff?
I think I would definitely adapt. When I read the Bone Witch series by Rin Chupeco, I really loved, I thought that it had a very cinematic quality to it. And I think it's interesting in one of the articles we're going to be talking about how that world building aspect was such a big part of, you know, what gets adapted. And I think in terms of world building, that was a good one. And especially with Shadow and Bone having come out recently and like the interest in YA fantasy with that super epic feel. I mean, this one's sort of YA adult because it was Shadow and Bone and Six of Crows. But you know what I mean? Like, there is definitely an interest in in YA stuff. And I thought The Bone Witch was great. And I would love to see more, like, dark fantasy become adapted. And that's, I think, a popular one. So I don't even know if that's, like, under the radar ask. But a lot of the stuff I like because I'm a terrible series reader, I just never finish series, are standalone things, which I don't think work as well or are not as much of interest. But I think like Becky Chambers series.
That's the Wayfarer series,
yeah,
right?
The Wayfarer series, especially with everybody being so into comfortable sort of found family stuff. Yeah. And this is very much an ensemble cast series. And it's so flexible, like between the different books that can work as standalones. I think that would be such a great and easy thing to adapt. So those are two picks, one fantasy, one science fiction off the top of my head. That are not necessarily under the radar, I guess, but maybe the wider world of readers have not come across.
Oh, definitely. I think when we're comparing them to Dune or Foundation, certainly Lord of the Rings, those are the radar. And these are much different in terms of awareness.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned two things I think are really interesting. I think there is, I don't think there's any like totally open space in the science fiction and fantasy adaptation realm. I do think going darker is interesting. And I think I haven't read The Bone Witch, but my sense, and I think you just backed it up a little bit, is that it is darker. I don't know if it verges on horror or not, but I think there might be an appetite out there for something that is a little more hair-raising than spectacular, which Shadow and Bone more is a spectacle than creeping you out, scare you. I think there might be a little bit there too. And then I think the Becky Chambers, I love that series. And I think might be a good TV show series, but I think the thing that a standalone or a series like that doesn't have, that the Dunes, the Foundations, the Shadow and Bones have, is if they hit, it can be a theme park. It can be a series of spin-off novels. It can be the multiverse. Like, you could, the goal here for all these properties, especially if they're being acquired by multi-trillion dollar tech conglomerates, is to make it into a Marvel cinematic universe. Like, that's the goal, is like that you could have a product that could be a Star Wars, that could be a Harry Potter, that could be a, what was the one I just said? A Marvel. And we haven't gotten that yet, because Game of Thrones is going to try. Lord of the Rings is trying. DC, I'm not sure we'd say that's successful. They keep making stuff, and would you say that's a success on the whole? But the brass ring here is insert letter cinematic universe that you can have 50 years of content out of, right? I mean, I think that's what everyone's looking for on that space. Now, you and I, as sort of pop culture people, I would be thrilled to get a really good standalone adaptation of The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern. But it's not going to be more than that. It's just, it isn't, unfortunately.
Well, see, this is interesting because it's where I, as a reader and viewer, kind of diverge from probably what people who are in the business of adapting things are looking for. Because I love and much more prefer like limited series where I know there's going to be an ending, that it's not just going to. And this is a problem with some of these like bigger sort of franchisey works, is that they milk them and they milk them and they milk them. And sometimes, because there is no real end in sight and the ending is not prioritized as a thing they care about, I like that a limited series is not going to fizzle out in terms of an ending or just be canceled before I get a chance to have a satisfying conclusion. And so I agree that there are not a lot of works out there that are adaptable into this big, you know, Marvel Cinematic Universe style situation. And there's a part of me that's glad for it, maybe.
Yeah. No, it's true. And Netflix has done an interesting thing. I've seen them, I've read a little bit about their strategies. They don't really want a series that's going to run for 20 years. What they want is something that'll run for a little while, and then they cancel it for a couple reasons. One is, you know, this is going back to the old broadcast days, where it wasn't the first two seasons of Friends that got expensive to make for Warner. It was when they were paying all those folks $1 billion and everyone had a stake, and they knew it was worth a lot, so they could get a lot out of it. So your costs ramp up. But what Netflix wants is new subscribers, and they want to keep people around. So they want to turn over the properties, right? They're not going to look into make a new Shadow and Bone every year for the next 50 years. They want people to keep their subscription and bring new people in, which is, I'm not sure if you're a Stranger Things fan or not, but I kind of am. I've watched them all. What's interesting about that is there's no urgency in turning it over, because they want to bring it back every couple years to bring people back into the fold who maybe let their Netflix, you know, subscription lapse or something else like that. They don't want to do 27 Stranger Things movies, because what they want is new people coming in, and they need new properties to get new people by definition, because the people already subscribe already like the properties have. So somehow they have to it's a very weird game, as opposed to a movie theater, right, which they just want your money, and or Marvel, where I just need you to like the next Marvel thing and pay for it. I don't care if you get the subscription or not. And that's a Disney. It's a completely different thing, where it's basically, if you're a parent, it's like a tax on your life, Disney Plus, because it's so valuable. But anyway, it's a different thing. So the various things make more sense. My brother was just texting me this morning. He's like, you like the Watchmen series, right? I was like, yes. He's like, I just plowed through it. And it's interesting, because like, do you know if there's another season? And I said, I don't think so. Lindelof has said he doesn't want it, but I would watch another season, but I'm kind of glad there isn't. I'm kind of like that. It's over now.
Yeah.
And we can, you know, take it on. I agree with you. And that's one of the reasons that I coined the phrase O'Neill's Razor of, I typically don't read a book series until it's done because A, I know when it's done because I did this thing to myself with, I think it was The Rothfuss that I'm still waiting on.
Oh,
I didn't
gosh.
Know it was a trilogy. I read the first one. I thought it was standalone. It's like, oh, there's another one? Where's the third book? That was 10 years ago, Sharifa. So I don't want to do that.
Fresh. Yeah.
So anyway, I agree with you in that regards too. Let me get to a little feedback here. Some really great feedback. This really hit a nerve. Let me say this. The property that people mentioned several times, that they were also mentioning as something they cared about, also that surprised Rebecca and I didn't think of it, is the Saga series by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples, which I totally agree with. If I would have thought of it, I would have mentioned it.
Wow,
again,
yeah.
It's not up there with Dune. It's not up. It just isn't that kind of a property. But in terms of something that's super interesting, I think would be really fascinating as a sort of like stranger, bringing some of the Game of Thrones adult content into space and some of the larger things that go on there. I think that'd be great. Vaughn and Staples have talked, I believe, if I remember correctly, about clearly being super reticent to do it for a lot of the reasons. I think they saw what happened to Game of Thrones and they're not done writing it, I don't think. And
yeah.
What do you, you know, you really lose control of it. But I think that would be my number one draft pick if I was acquiring to take a shot on. Are you a Saga person, Sharif? I don't think I know this.
I read the first volume of Saga and I loved it, but it was one of those, again, terrible reader of anything that has lots of books or lots of comics because, you know, I just move from one thing to the next. But I do see, like, when you consider something like The Walking Dead, which is based off of a massive comic series, then it makes sense that would be adaptation friendly. But yeah, in terms of like the greater franchisey world, especially because it's not done, and I don't actually know how many issues are in the series.
I'm behind, so. I think, because I would read them in like the volumes, you know, and I don't know how many.
Yeah,
I think maybe an annual same. Volume, and I have the first one. It's beautiful, and then I read on. I guess it was on Libby or something, or Comixology, I don't know. But on my iPad, I did the second volume, but I lost track of it. O'Neill's Razor for comics is a disaster. It means you can't ever read a comic, essentially.
Right.
so I've been looking for a way to get back into it, but I don't know. You and I are aligned in that regard. I want to spend a little time on this email that Chris wrote in, and this person got really into it. So what they did is they went into Goodreads and looked at series and then looked at the ones that had the most reviews and then took the top 15 that haven't been adapted to say, here's, you know, just in terms of mind share, this is a pretty good proxy for what people know. I think that's a pretty fair, I mean, you could do a lot worse than trying to guess what a proxy for awareness is, right, Sharifa?
Yeah.
I can't even think of what else I would do than this.
No, I think that's very clever. I'm very curious.
All right. So I'll read through them and I'll kind of go slowly and you stop me if you want to pause on one. And
okay.
Then maybe at the end, we're going to come back to it and think. So, and I'm apologize. Some of these names are my first time ever saying them, the Reader's Curse. So here we go. Victoria Aveyard's The Red Queen series, PC Cass' House of Night series, Sylvia Day's Crossfire series. I should also, these are all science fiction fantasy, not anything else. Robin Hood's The Farseers, Ursula K. Le Guin's The Hainish Cycle, Marie Lu's Legend, Sarah J. Maas' A Court of Thorn and Roses, which I think Rebecca and I mentioned as one that's got some juice in it.
Yeah.
Anne McCaffrey's The Dragon Riders of Pern. Do you know that series? Did you grow up
Yeah,
with that
I know one? Of it. I know a lot of people are obsessed with that series.
Yeah, it's the most that has the longest like shelf life because the first book of that came in 1968. So it's been out there. Let's see. I'm sorry. Pausing here. Marissa Meyer's The Lunar Chronicles, Garth Nix's Sabriel series, Tamora Pierce's Song of the Lioness, Patrick Rothfuss' Kingkiller Chronicles, though I'm taking off because it's not over, and we don't know if that book's coming out. So it's on there, but there it is. Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn, Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples' Saga, and then Scott Westerfeld's Uglies. I mentioned Saga. Does anything else jump out to you there, Sharifa, for good or for ill? Something be more popular than you thought or less popular? Where would you go, or where does your interest take you?
I definitely can see something in A Court of Thorns and Roses. That is a huge series, yeah. Like in terms of like just the world as well as readership. But one that that came to mind as I was listening to this list that I was surprised wasn't at the top and also is being adapted is The Valdemar Universe by Mercedes Lackey, which is literally 3,000 years of story. So, but yeah, all of those, there were some of these books are completely off my radar just because I don't generally read the most popular books. I'm over here in my nerd hole reading a lot of like niche reads and things like that. But those all sounded familiar in terms of like, even as somebody who is not dialed into the more popular fantasy and science fiction works, I'm like, oh yeah, I hear a lot of people talking about these books. So in terms of scope, I don't necessarily know how big all of them are.
I don't think any of them, none of them are even, if the Dune Foundation, I'd say Dune and Foundation are B-level properties, right? Yeah. Lord of the Rings is an A-level property. Star Wars, A-level. Marvel, A-level. I think Dune and Foundation at this point are B-level properties. Could they be A-levels? Maybe. Harry Potter is an A-level series. I'm trying to think of what else is an A-level property out there. That might be kind of it, frankly. There aren't that many. I think we move from Dune Foundation at B. And again, this isn't about grades. This is just about scales of awareness or popularity or mind share. I think we're dropping way down. I don't know what letter, but this is not C and D here. I don't see any C and Ds here. I've lost track of what is useful. I was going to say F, but that sounds like a flunking grade. So like, I think we're HI. It's like we're middle of the alphabet. We're not at the bottom, but none of these have much juice, I think, beyond like you and I do books for a living. And we're lukewarm on most of these. I think that's telling, Sharifa, frankly.
I think so, too. I do think it's rare for something that big, like the A-level world, to come along. It's not an easy thing to create, and I guess that's not surprising to anybody.
No, and they get sold for billions of dollars if they ever do it. And that's been done. I think it's interesting to think about. You mentioned The Walking Dead, which is an interesting category because that's a property that certainly moved up several notches because of the adaptation and the popularity of that show. Like, that was a popular comic, but it didn't rely on the popularity of the comic to have some juice, and it's elevated that property. And I don't know, they're on season 28 at this point. I don't even know.
I have lost count.
they've lost count, but that certainly is. So you can move up a level or two. You know, I would say that was probably an F or G level property. That's now a D level property. Is it? I don't think it's Dune or Foundation.
No,
but
no.
It's, you know, it's certainly in the top quartile of series that are out there. I'm trying to think of another one that's really elevated the source material into a different category. I'm not really coming up with a good one right now.
Yeah.
It's hard
I'm
to
sure
think
they're
about.
Out there.
There must be podcast at bookriot.com. I'm sure there's something that I'm forgetting. You know, the Why the Last Man that's coming out. Are there some other comic ones? Watchmen is an interesting case where it certainly had a pop culture moment, mainstream culture moment over last year. But Watchmen was already like the hipster, like literary pick. Like, it's hard to think that it did much more in terms of its status. And it wasn't a direct adaptation, other things like that. But it's possible to move up. In terms of things that could move up, I think Shadow and Bone was pretty well received. If we have another good series, it might get some escape velocity, become its own pop culture property.
Yeah, because the Grishaverse is a big world.
It's a big one.
And there are lots of different characters to explore and places and timelines.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and Foundation, like you with the series you mentioned, Foundation happens over millennia. Not merely decades, not merely centuries, but it is in the Lord of the Rings Foundation, like you've got multiple millennia you can deal with here, which is funny to think about as something that's actually useful, where you see Star Wars that's starting to feel claustrophobic a little bit, especially as we got towards the end of the the Sky. It was trying to find some escape velocity from the Skywalker saga. The Mandalorians had some success. We'll see how endurable or extensible it is beyond just people like Baby Yoda and someone that looks like Boba Fett. It'd be interesting to see if there's things that other come out there. I think the Dragon Riders of Pern is fascinating. As much joy as there is in Mudville in science fiction, or especially fantasy for dragons, we don't have a great dragon series. I mean, Game of Thrones used dragons sort of sparingly, yeah. But like dragons as main characters, haven't figured that one out yet. I feel like there might be some juice into something like that.
Yeah, and judging from how they don't seem to be afraid of spending scads of cash right. on these That's things, right. that could be likely.
there were some very bad live action plus CGI. There was Dragonheart, where like Sean Connery voiced a dragon.
Right,
that
I saw that. Wow.
I think that's one, maybe like Dune, that our CGI abilities and stomach for the budget required could make it where that's feasible to make something that looks good and that can become, you know, something else in the future. Yeah, those are interesting. I think basically saga is maybe the exception that proves the rule of it's really going to be something that has to be good on its own terms and find an audience on its own terms as it gets adapted. You're not getting a lot of base coming into week one or the first series on Netflix from most of these things. You're just not. There's just not much out there to see what comes from it. Okay, thank you for that. Let's do another sponsor break and come back and talk about some other news.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story could make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out, and thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee. So I am super excited about this one. It has what sounds like a really interesting, unique magic system. It is a medical magic system, and the world is based in a Vietnam-inspired fantasy world. And it follows Nika, who is what you call a blood carver. And blood carvers are these beings who can alter human biology with a single touch. Now, to people like Thumas, she is a monster who can be traded for gold. So one day she gets caught and she's forced to heal the last witness to a high-profile murder. And all signs in her investigation point to an alluring physician's aide, Cochin. But then she discovers Cochin is not who he says he is, and she's suddenly faced with a greater evil lurking in the city. Now, her only chance to survive lies in a choice. She can become the monster the city fears or risk the future of her kind. Amazing. I'm so excited. Make sure to check out the new book, and thanks again to The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee for sponsoring this episode.
Speaking of adaptation, so I provided Sharifa our agenda and I said, okay, what are these things are you most interested in? And what did you pick? What was your number one draft choice and Jeff's potpourri of agenda items here?
I chose this Atlantic piece that I thought was really fascinating. It's The Rise of Must-Read TV. This was reported on by Alexander Manchel, Laura B. McGrath, and J.D. Porter. I thought this was fascinating because it's like the intersection. I probably love film and television as much as books, which right. is a daring thing perhaps to say on a book podcast.
Yeah,
but
fine. You're all, yeah. all friends here.
So I thought this was really interesting because, you know, anecdotally, I am constantly hearing about adaptations. I mean, that's what we've been just talking about. And so there's this data that was drawn from Publishers Marketplace about the rise in television-specific adaptations of books. And so the site listed like 4,000 film and television deals, and the TV deals have increased dramatically. Both of them have. But TV adaptations have just been reported to exceed film adaptations for the first time ever, which got like my wheels spinning about all of the reasons that might be. Streaming has just become such a booming industry. I definitely watch a lot more streaming TV and TV adaptations than I do film adaptations. They're just a lot more front of mind. So this article did a deep dive into this new data and really went into analyzing a lot of the things we were just talking about, like how, you know, the adaptation can elevate the popularity of a work. Like they mentioned Bridgerton, that became a huge hit, and those books rose in popularity because of that adaptation, and a lot of things. Like it's easy to tell why that is. It gets widespread to a bigger audience of viewers. And so it also talks about or asks the question of like, well, does this mean that, you know, is this a bad thing? Is it a bad thing that maybe now that adaptations are happening and there are all of these people who are basically being hired to scout out mm-hmm. books that are perfect for TV adaptations, are we now coming into this territory where agents are asking for books that are perfect for television adaptation? Writers are writing for TV adaptations because these deals are happening now. Like, as the book deal is being inked, so too are these TV rights and adaptation rights being inked. So it's just it's a huge and interesting piece that just made me think about how adaptations are happening in a different way and how mm-hmm. books are being written and what makes a perfect TV-specific adaptation. I just thought this was really fascinating.
It's definitely worth reading. If you like this show, if you are listening to this show, which you are, otherwise you wouldn't be hearing me say those words, go read this. It's in The Atlantic. It's really great. Sharifa mentioned the people, and there's a link in the show notes, bookriot.com/listen. And I don't want to go through it beat by beat, but there's so much here mm-hmm. that I want to sort of pick out a couple of things. And the one, start with the top, which is, I think the thing that you mentioned got your wheel spinning the most was just the aggregate numbers of total literary adaptations, film versus TV. What's interesting now, 2020 pandemic, adaptations are hard, but relatively speaking, in 2020, there were about 80 TV adaptations and about, I'm eyeballing this, about 60 film adaptations. So even in a pandemic year, there were 80 TV adaptations. Now, comparing that to 20 years ago when the survey starts in 20, it looks like 2000. So that's within our 20 years. My adult life of being in the culture, the number in 2000 was 6. So we've gone from 6 to 80 in 20 years. And actually, the peak for TV was 2018, in which there were 120 adaptations. I think this is a pandemic thing that we can see a drop that happens there. But film's fall is even more precipitous. That the most recent peak was 2018. So in 2018, when TV was peaking, or the last peak, I guess, is one way of thinking about it, there's 120 adaptations, and there were about 130-ish, it looks like 135-ish films. So very close. But the peak of film adaptations was in 2008 with 210 film adaptations in 1 year. So we've come all the way down from 210 to 60 with the asterisk by 2020. But even if you go back to 2018, it's fallen by 50-ish percent. That's streaming. I think you hit the nail on the head. That's a streaming thing. There's more TV shows, and they're coming down. I'd also like to know what the base rate is. Like, how many films were made? Were there just more films made in 2008?
That could be true.
You know, and what do we call a film? Like, does a 90-minute feature that show up on Netflix, are they calling that a film? Because that didn't exist in 2008, a Netflix original film. Those were all Netflix. Did we even have streaming on Netflix in 2008? I don't think we did.
I don't think so.
I can't remember when that really came. You can see between the, there was sort of a pretty steady between 2002, 2008, a pretty steady of 20 to 30 adaptations a year for TV. 2009, we get a leg up and it really just goes, it looks, start to look like the Himalayas from there, which is fascinating. I think when you were a younger person, like when you were a kid, so we're not too, I'm older than you are, but that's not like a whole generation. But when we were kids, it was really rare to see a book made into a TV show. It just didn't happen in the 90s. Can you think of one that was made into an ongoing TV show? There might be like a Lifetime movie or something.
A lot like of the ones I remember were mostly miniseries.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, no, it wasn't an ongoing TV series. I truly cannot remember a single one. I'm like racking my 90s brain for anything.
Podcastofbookride.com. Hit us up. I'm the same. I was kind of setting you up to fail because I had the same problem. Like, I can't think of anything.
Maybe like Sweet Valley High was a thing that was adapted for, but I don't think that series lasted long, to be fair, on TV. But that was one. That's the only one I can think of.
Now, there was prestige. So, like, I think the thing you're hearing us talk around, which is a little uncomfortable to say, is that it was thought of, if you couldn't get your film made into a movie, a limited series that was going to run on CBS or Lifetime was like way down the prestige ladder. And I think probably in terms of the pay as well, right?
Yeah.
It was a completely different world to have your book made into a movie than it was to have, say, I don't know, I'm going to pick one at random, The Hours by Muckle Cunningham, right?
Mm-hmm.
Prestigious literary fiction, I think won the Pulitzer Prize. I can't remember. There's stickers on it. Whatever it was, there was a sticker, that was a crossover literary fiction hit that got made into a pretty mediocre movie starring Ed Harris and Nicole Kidman and her nasal prosthetic, which is really the star of that movie. If they didn't get made to a movie, they were not making that into a TV movie. It was not happening. It just did not. The English Patient, if it wasn't made into a movie, they were not making it into a TV show. So it wasn't even like a fallback position. Like, those were the two options. In the 70s, there was like North and South, the Thornbirds. Like, there was a period in which Roots, maybe the best example of a big-time movie being made into a big-time television adaptation. But for whatever reason, I don't know the history of TV well enough to know why in the early to mid-90s, when I was doing most of my TV watching, that strata completely disappeared. Maybe a rise of prestige TV on The Sopranos, The Wire, 6 Feet Under. Interesting, like that era was the golden age for original properties to become prestige TV shows. Now you almost need a book or something else to base on. Very rare you see an original script given the whole that kind of room to run, or at least much more common. So I think that's definitely the case. It's just they're willing to pay up for mid-list prestige literary fiction in a way that they just weren't to on TV, and TV is something else too. This article sort of claims that people now write, I think, I can't pick out a sentence, but tell me if your gut reading of this is, or your reading of this was similar to mine. It's sort of making the argument that since there's so many more adaptations, that it's affecting what people write. Like, more people are writing to be adapted than they were back in the day. I don't think I buy that. And I'll tell you why. I think people wanted to be adapted into a movie. And they were thinking about whether or not something could be a movie, and, you know, casting in their head and other things like that. I just think more people are successful now in having the thing they wrote and getting made to a TV show. What's your take on my counter thesis? Is that actually, I'm not sure that, I think writers for a long time have thought about their stuff being made into a movie eventually, and that's not anything new necessarily, though I don't have any data around that. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, it does. It's interesting because I think that there is, in my mind, before I even read this article, I was just like, well, there's such a big thirst for stories to turn into TV series, especially on streaming, that I just thought it made sense that, of course, like, there are stories to be had right at people's fingertips because there are books to pull from. So, yeah, I agree that writers have probably thought about having their books adapted for film, definitely more so than TV. I don't know if people are as dialed into the fact that, you know, TV is seeing this big boom versus film, and people have a very, like, when people think, is this a cinematic story I'm telling, it's probably what they're talking about is it cinematic right. for film? Like, that's just what it is. And they do kind of go into that in this article. And they talk about what makes it, like, what types of stories are particularly appealing. But then they also, like, ask, is contemporary literature being dumbed down by authors, agents, and publishers motivated by profit and struck with this severe bout of adaptation envy? And I thought that that was the interesting question there.
Right.
And they say no. The answer is no. TLDR.
Yeah, there's like they say no, but then they make. So I'm going to just read a little. You covered a bit of this. They say episodic plots, ensemble casts, and high production value settings. These are the features that, although not at all new to the novel, they cite Middlemarch. I'm just thinking Dickens. You know, that's where my brain went. They've always existed, but, and I'm skipping down, as the figures and examples above illustrate, the rise of streaming and its love of literature have not only influenced which books are read, taught, and studied by scholars, they have also started to mediate the form fiction takes. Which does suggest that it is shaping, started to shape the form fiction takes. So, but if it's always been this way, then how can it be forming? There's something I'm missing.
Yeah, I think that that's a, I don't think it's necessarily, if it is shaping things, I don't think it's like in any significant way. Like maybe there's somebody right. out there who's like, well, everything I write is going to be a TV adaptation hit. Like, that's what mm-hmm. I'm going for here. But I don't think so. If that is the question, like, personally, coming from a very academic and scientific place, I don't think that's true. But it is very vague in how, like, it is very a little bit wishy-washy in how they go back and forth there.
It did make me think the mention of Faulkner reminded me of something I've been meaning to bring up on the show for a while. Faulkner, you know, famously worked in Hollywood as a screenwriter. And that was something that a lot of people have done, right? They write, you know, Fitzgerald did this famously, and a bunch of other people have as well. One thing that is relatively new, since there are so many more TV series, and TV series need a lot more screenwriting, right? Because you have more mm-hmm. hours to fill. That means you have more pages to fill. That means there's probably more people writing for screen than have ever written before by an order of magnitude. You need a lot more bodies here. And one thing I have noticed is, and again, I'm more plugged into the world of books and reading than I was when I was much younger, but novelists who have a book come out and then they get hired into a writing room or they get a series. So we've seen this happen with Angela Flournoy, for example, who wrote The Turner House. I interviewed on Reading Live, part of Book Riot Live back in the day. Shout out to all those people that remember that show or that event. Hasn't had another book come out, and she's probably working one, but I know she's also working on a TV show.
Yeah.
Matt Johnson, who is a writer in residence, I think, at University of Oregon, or maybe the adjunct here in Portland. Pym, great comedic novelist. Hasn't had a novel out in a while, but I know is working in a writer's room somewhere. I'm not exactly sure. Attica Locke wrote Bluebird, Bluebird, and I can't remember the sequel to that. Also is working on a TV show. And so that's one pull I'd be interested to see. Are there more people who have a novel or two that then get a TV show than there used to be? Has to be. But how much is that pulling where the storytelling is happening rather than the adaptation, that you're just pulling the story towards directly to the screen? Like, they're using the novel, their book, to sort of prove their bona fides as a storyteller, mm-hmm. and then they get scouted, headhunted to come into a writer's room or to be executive producer or something else. I think that is probably way newer than anything about the form of story here to see, or at least that'd be my suspicion at this point.
That's an interesting one, because I don't have a lot of examples. I know of some authors who are currently, like, working on their adaptations in the writer's room, but it would be interesting to see, like, where do they go from there? Are they going to stick around? I don't know.
Yeah, like, how much of, like, say, Nnedi Okorafor's brain space is taken up about trying to adapt the stuff that she's written, right? I mean, I think that's another thing that's interesting, is a lot of the creators who are having something adapted, and I don't know if it's because the showrunners, the powers that be, the suits, want them in the writing process, or they have more juice, and N.K. Jemisin or someone else is saying, No, I'm not going to just sell you the option. I want to have creative control or say, I want to be in the room where it happens about what words are actually going to show up on the screen. Mm-hmm. But it's curious, like how many novelists are spending how much more of their time working on adaptations directly, either of theirs or of just working on original work for the screen? Because it feels like a lot of the juice is getting sucked up that way. It feels like there's a lot of people that are dividing their time that way.
I would say so, because there was a time when I remember, like, I would tell people, well, you know, a lot of the time when you see these adaptations, the writers of the original books, like, they really had nothing to do with it. They had no say in the creative choice, much less like what actually is said on the screen and how the actual, you know, the screenwriting aspect of it. So, very new.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Another just last note of this particular article is I thought this was really smart, where they looked at how often a book that has been adapted versus a similar one that hasn't been adapted is cited in academic circles, right?
Yeah.
And they said something that's been adapted has about twice as many academic citations as something that isn't, which on the face of it, I'd be like, kind of like, duh, right? Because it's more popular. But you would think academics would be, if anyone's going to be more insulated from the cultural weight of something having a more mainstream life, it would be academics. And it doesn't, it doubles. It's just way different. Now, again, there's a lot of things that aren't adapted, and probably to a first approximation, you could, as a rounding error, 0% of things are adapted in terms of things that actually get written. But it really does matter. So it has its own weight. But I don't know. I mean, are then things that are adapted, are things adapted because they're more likely to be written about and talked about as well? I mean, it's an interesting chicken and the egg situation. But if you feel like there's a lot more literary adaptations, you're right. Congratulations to us for noticing that. It is interesting, too, in the history of the show. It used to be that if there was an adaptation of, like, you know, significant but not earth-shattering import, we would spend 6 minutes talking about Celeste Ng's book getting picked up for an adaptation. We couldn't do that now because every show would have 40 items of things getting adapted. So the specialness of adaptation has also gone away. I just hope writers are getting paid and helps them make the stories they want to. That's my story here. That's all. That's what I want for everyone is the writers and creators to get paid and make the kind of stuff they want to make. Let's see. Where do we? I guess speaking of this, the worlds of adaptations, creators, curators, and big dollars. Hello, Sunshine. Which is Reese Witherspoon's, well, I should say was Reese Witherspoon's, I don't even know what you call it, production company? They do all kinds of stuff, from producing, adapting, to running book clubs, you know, they're dipping their toes into e-commerce, sold to a private equity group who basically seems to me is trying to build, they want to be a arms manufacturer for the streaming wars, for the adaptation, for the media wars. And so they're rolling up Hello Sunshine. It sounds like they've got more money to go buy other things like Hello Sunshine, where they're acquiring talent, they're acquiring taste making, they're acquiring a sensibility and know-how to go out and find certain kinds of books, package them up, get development deals, and sell them to Apple or sell them to someplace else. And I'm not really sure how much you followed what Hello Sunshine does, but it seems to me that Reese Witherspoon and her team, she's the public face of it. I don't know the other people here. There's a bunch of people mentioned here. Mm-hmm. What is the value? Because they don't own IP necessarily. They have a pipeline. They have people that have connections. But everything that Reese, say, picks for her book club that she could adapt would seem to be available to anyone else to go scout and adapt. I think maybe the value here is that you're good at it, you have a good sensibility, you have some brand recognition even within the industry, so someone will sell to you, someone will take your call, do all those other things, are worth a lot of money. But $900 million for Hello Sunshine.
That's a lot.
It's, I mean, again, this is dumb because this is how math works, but that's almost $1 billion. Now you're talking about, you could have had Lord of the Rings rights for that. I mean, seriously, what do you think is more valuable? The Lord of the Rings rights or Hello Sunshine? They're saying they're equivalent, which is mind blowing to me. Sharifa, do you have a take on this, or are we just going to like get that bag, Reese, and get out of here on this particular story? any other thoughts about it?
My big thought on it is that I do feel like they are paying for that brand recognition. Like, Reese Witherspoon's book club is like a big deal with a lot of people. And the shows that have the productions that have come out of Hello Sunshine have been some big hits with a lot of buzz, like, you know, Big Little Lies and Little Fires Everywhere are noted here, as well as The Morning Show, which maybe a little bit less. But, you know, those are big, successful enterprises that have come out of Hello Sunshine. But I think it is definitely like basically paying for Witherspoon and, you know, that recognition. Hello Sunshine is a big name. But I was also just blown away by the amount. It was staggering to me. And it always, it perhaps always is. These money exchanges are always attached to big amounts of money that I cannot even begin to understand. So, yeah, I would say, grab your bag, I guess.
Grab the bag and get out, or you know, make sure it vests or whatever you've got to do to get that. I was trying to explain to someone what Hello Sunshine was, and I don't know the business that well. Rebecca and I have followed the book club, Reese's production company, sort of orthogonal to what we're related to. The best comparison I could think of is like thinking of Paltrow's Goop, but for like TVs and books and movies.
Yeah.
Like it's curatorial, it's a mindset, it's an attitude. And I don't mean to dismiss, I'm not trying to downplay either Hello Sunshine. Goop is a giant e-commerce juggernaut. Like that you're listening to this and you know what I'm talking about defines that. But what its product is a lot less substantial than I think we would assume $100 million or almost $1 billion worth of enterprise is. I mean, Lucas sold Star Wars for $7 billion to Disney. So you're saying Hello Sunshine is worth 1/7 of Star Wars? Maybe Star Wars is underpriced. That's certainly possible, especially at this point with knowing how valuable these properties are. But I think what we're finding, if this number is even close to being a fair market value, is now that there's so many outlets and now that there's so many properties and now that there's so many different platforms, a differentiating factor might be taste. What gets put on those, what you decide to make is more as it's as important as what rights you own, or how many subscribers do you have your platform. Pretty interesting here. We're going to do some juicy gossip stuff in a minute. Anything else on that, Sharifa?
No, that's it. It feels like very like the mega version of influencers, but I've got nothing more.
Yes, it does feel that way. Like influencers within the industry. Influencers, something like that. It's a great point.
Yeah.
All right. Sponsor break. And then we don't do Gossip Corner that often, but this is a weird one that we have to talk about. Or I have to talk about just from a Sharifa can stay mum and above the fray if she wants to. But we'll come back and talk about it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy Eilin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy Eilin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
I don't think this matters in any way that's going to affect the world of books and reading. It's just a strange story that reminds me how strange, I guess not unlike the Hello Sunshine world, about the kind of dollars we're talking about, even for Scholastic, which people don't, I don't think about it on par with Random House and HarperCollins and some of these big ones that are owned by. Scholastic is largely privately held, which I had forgotten, but there's major stakeholders and it's one dude, and the dude died. I'm just going to abstract this here, Dick Robinson, Richard Robinson. And he left his controlling stake in Scholastic to an old flame, essentially. Someone who'd been working at Scholastic who he had a relationship with. And not too surprising that his ex-wife, this is how these things happen when people get divorced, you don't usually leave things to your old partner. But then his kids didn't get any of it and went all to his old flame, who does have business acumen. She was running it, but it really was a, as much as there's insider gossip on the bookish internet, this had a day, Sharifa. Jen dropped it in, said, is there something here? It's like, for most book people, there isn't, but I'm like fascinated by this. It's like Succession on HBO kind of level of plot twist of like, wait a minute, you left it to her, not to me, Dad, but you're dead, and now we're going to fight it out in court. But a wild story. And people have too much money. I guess that's my other takeaway, Sharifa. Was there anything else in this story that you thought was worth noting? Or should we just mention that this is a wild one?
I just got the vibes of, like, you know, there's that scene in so many movies of a certain type where everybody in the family is just in that one very serious looking room listening to the reading of the will, and then this big scandal is unveiled, and, like, you know, that one person is the same sort of thing, that old flame or whatever got everything. And I was just like, I can't believe this is actually happening in the publishing world. It's kind of like wild. But
it really is. That's why I say it feels more like something out of a TV show than
Yeah, you're totally right. I got that exact feeling from this story, and ooh, that's gonna be a tough one for that family to unravel.
Here's a question for all you probate lawyers out there, if we have anyone listening. Is the scene of the family gathered in leather chairs in a den somewhere, and someone opens up, a lawyer opens up the envelope to read, is that something that actually happens? Or is that just something that TV and movies told us is a scene? Is that a real thing? Or, like, how does this work now? I'd assume you just get an email at this point. But, like, this idea of, like, we're getting the family, but, like, it happens in Knives Out. Like, it happens in, like, every other Agatha Christie novel, I feel like there's one of these scenes. Like, where did this come from, of this primordial scene of the reading of the will? And did it ever exist? Is this the real thing out in the universe?
I want it to be true.
BookRiot.com.
Yeah.
Do you want this to be true? I guess I live in fear of that moment. If I ever have to go to a will reading in which I'm summoned into a country manor house, and there's sort of this fustian old lawyer reading, I just assume some stuff is about to go down. Like, who's about to get murdered? Who was murdered?
Mm-hmm.
Who is not the daughter they thought they were? Who's not biologically related? I'm just going to be very nervous. Be aware going into a will reading. Wear a body armor. Get a DNA test. Have your friends and family DNA tested ahead of time. Don't be surprised. Protect yourself and your loved ones going into the will reading.
Hercule Poirot is going to Kool-Aid man into the room and
and
maybe save the day. I don't know.
That's right. I think we're going to end on maybe we'll just mention it because it's another long read that Rebecca and I have talked about on the show from time to time. And I think we had a piece on the site recent-ish about Goodreads' problems. I don't think it's anything. Goodreads doesn't necessarily do anything proactively to make it problems, but when you have an openish platform in which people can influence the public perception of someone just by brute force, just by trying, you have a whole bunch of weird stuff that can happen. So this piece is titled How Extortion Scams and Review Bombing Trolls Turn Goodreads into Many Authors' Worst Nightmare. If that doesn't get you interested as a World of Books and Reading story person, I don't know what to tell you. Starts out with a terrifying anecdote. This is by Megan McCluskey, writing in Time. Basically, people finding an angle that I can threaten authors with terrible reviews, one-star review bombing, and they have to pay me not to do it, which is like classic extortion, right?
Yeah.
This was eye-opening. I don't know a way around this necessarily. I mean, this is how someone described it. Went on the record, by the way. Aaron Stein, an editor and publisher at Macmillan Children's, called Goodreads a necessary evil. Sharifa.
Ouch.
If anyone describes Book Riot as a necessary evil, I hope we're getting paid a lot more money because that's a lot of influence, but that's not what you want if you've started a company in books and reading, right? You don't want to be called a necessary evil, I don't think.
No, I would pack my bags and go off the grid and be like, oh my. I do hope this is... It is definitely well worth reading this whole thing because it is like, talk about scandalizing. And some of this I knew going in just from like, you know, sometimes people will post things, authors are tweeting about Goodreads and their experiences. And you hear about other situations where it's like some author said something terrible and people go and review bomb. There are so many things about Goodreads reviews. There's so much to unpack there about like all of the ways those reviews get used that are not necessarily straightforward reviews. The extortion is one piece of it that is like a truly awful and significant piece of it. And I do hope that with this article coming out, Goodreads will take a real close look at their processes. And toward the end of the article, they talk about how kind of loosey-goosey the process of actually making an account is, which is kind of, there's a big problem here. And I don't think it's going to take like a Band-Aid or going on a case-by-case basis to fix this issue. Especially with things like between the extortion and the one-star reviews for marginalized authors who speak out on the internet about things, ways they've been wronged, like between all of the things that are listed here and probably more, there's a really good reason for Goodreads to take a close look. But they're a huge company, and this is one of those situations where like, I feel frustrated on behalf of these people who are feeling very unheard by Goodreads because, you know, they can just go about their merry way and the repercussions for them aren't that big. But this is a big article, and I hope it brings attention to the problem.
I hope it does, too. I mean, Time writing about this, and Time isn't what it once was in its glory days. Of course, we all know that. But it's different than something appearing on Our Side or Bustle or, you know, LitHub or something like that. It just has a different valence. And I wonder what happens. Rin Chubico, who you shout out earlier, gets another shout out. Well, we'll give another shout out who's quoted at length here. This is a, this was an interesting idea that's become unmanageable is what she says. And she says her own experience with getting review bombed, not about her book, but about something else she says. So someone uses this as an attack surface to punish, silence, you know, otherwise coerce, and that's putting it maybe a little gently, basically hurt someone for doing something they didn't like. And as you say, you're right, it's a structural problem because to stop the kinds of things that people are saying are happening, and I believe them, of course, Goodreads would have to fundamentally reimagine what it means for someone to leave a review on the on someone's page, right? They would have to fundamentally do something different. I don't know, verified accounts, invest a lot more in moderation, have stricter guidelines about what's appropriate vectors of critique or review. And I'm not saying that's not a, well, it is a mess. It's a complete mess. And I understand why they're not doing it. I think they're wrong. I think if you're going to do this and want, and you are interested in being something other than a necessary evil, you have to allocate resources you've never done before. You have to scrub the graffiti off. You've got to clean up the bathroom. That's what's happening here is you have a public toilet, and this is a great idea. We need toilets. There's something that needs to be done here. This serves a function. But if you don't do something, it's going to be ruined in a tragedy of the commons kind of way, and people are going to find ways to exploit it. And that's what's happened. And it's not unlike a lot of social... Frankly, Goodreads is social media. It's not... It is. It just is. And it has all the structural pieces of social media for good and for ill. And I think we're finding the ill is... You can't separate the ill from the good without a lot of effort and a lot of work, and it's going to cost you money, and it's going to lower your share price, and it's going to be a lot harder, and you're going to make a whole bunch of people mad because you're changing something they were used to.
Yeah.
It's either do that or be okay with being a necessary evil. Those are your choices right now.
Those are some hard choices.
They ain't easy. But you know what? It's Amazon. I think their market cap now is $1.5 trillion.
Right.
If they wanted to, they could figure out. They could make efforts here. I mean, Rin Chubico says she had all this happen. She tried to email. She got no response from Goodreads. This is a published author from a major public house with multiple series. Couldn't get response. Couldn't get a response. Unbelievable.
Yeah. I should note also that they go by they, them.
Just oh, yes. Thank you very much for that. Yeah. It's not something I knew at the top of my head. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, no problem. This is a... It's been an ongoing issue, and I agree. Like, in my mind, I am definitely of the opinion that they need to... fix this, and they have the resources, and like, you know, I go to the place of like, do they even care? Like, is this a thing? Like, the fact that they you don't even need to verify your email address to create an account, that just tells me so much. Like, why?
Yeah,
I feel like everywhere else on the internet, at least you have to verify your email address. That's such a simple thing. So
yeah, I mean, It's one thing to say, boy, our house keeps getting robbed. But if you are you locking your doors? And you're like, well, no, I don't have a lock on my door. I feel like email verification is like at least a lock on your door, or
yeah,
at least keep, or even shutting your door. Maybe it's not even a lock, but like, we do email verification for stuff that we do, and we're not Goodreads, you know, entering all kinds of stuff. Anyway, long story short, that's a good pick out, Sharifa. Of boy, that's not even really. Because I could believe that they care, but the mountain to climb is so high that they don't care that much. But not having email verification to set up a profile is pretty damning.
I wonder maybe
if they did put out some base level preventative measures. Is this one of those things where a dollar's worth of preventative medicine would yield $1,000 in returns, just to provide any more friction for people that want to behave badly? I wonder about that.
Yep.
All right. That's our show. Sharifa, thank you so much for being here. As always, you can find show notes, bookriot.com/listen. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. I especially want to know about whether or not the primordial scene of the reading of the will has any basis in ongoing fact.
Same.
And I'll let Sharifa know. You can find Sharifa over there on SFFEI with Jen. You guys are podcasting every other week, right? You guys are together, and then you have individual ones in between where you do recommendations and a thing like that. What have you guys talked about recently? What have been some recent topics? I'm a little behind, so what's up to date in Kansas City with you guys?
Well, last time we went totally wild card, and we were just like, we're just recommending some books we really like. And then I actually had Vanessa as a guest on, Vanessa's the managing editor now, on the last one, and we basically gave everybody a summer reading list, which is like one of my favorite things in the world to do. So those are the most recent ones. And we talk about all the things all the time, including adaptations and pop culture. So find us.
Excellent. Sharifa, we'll talk to you next time.